In 1901, Representative George H. White of North Carolina was the only Negro in Congress. In his farewell speech, he summarized the Negro's tremendous accomplishments in the first 35 years of freedom, pointed out the most adverse circumstances under which these gains had been achieved, and then went on to say,
"You may tie us and then taunt us for our lack of bravery, but one day we will break the bonds. You may use our labor for 2.5 centuries and then taunt us for our poverty. But let me remind you, we will not always remain poor. You may withhold even the knowledge of how to read God's word and learn the way from earth to glory and then taunt us for our ignorance. But we would remind you that there is plenty of room at the top, and we are climbing. These parting words are in behalf of an outraged, heartbroken, bruised, and bleeding people, rising people, full of potential force. The only apology that I have to make for the earnestness with which I have spoken is that I am pleading for the life, the liberty, the future happiness, and manhood suffrage of 1/8 of the entire population of the United States."
How to achieve this potential? The black leadership was sharply divided in its views. Booker T. Washington was the spokesman for those who believed that the black man could succeed by accepting second-class citizenship and by avoiding conflict with his white neighbors. Washington spread his philosophy of self-help and industrial education throughout the South.
"Educate the black man mentally and industrially, and there will be no doubt of his prosperity. We shall prosper in the proportion as we learn to dignify and glorify common labor and put brains and skill into the common occupations of life. There is as much dignity in tilling a field as in writing a poem. I have always advised my race to give attention to acquiring property, intelligence, and character as the necessary basis of good citizenship rather than to mere political agitation."
Others, led by Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, strongly opposed Washington's views. They wanted integration with full equality into every aspect of American society, and they believed that it was vital to create a leadership class of well-educated Negroes. In his book, The Souls of Black Folk, Du Bois wrote,
"In the history of nearly all other races and peoples, the doctrine preached has been that manly self-respect is worth more than lands and houses, and that a people who voluntarily surrender such respect or cease striving for it are not worth civilizing. In answer to this, it has been claimed that the Negro can survive only through submission. Mr. Washington distinctly asks that black people give up, at least for the present, 3 things. First, political power. Second, insistence on civil rights. Third, higher education of Negro youth, and concentrate all their energies on industrial education, the accumulation of wealth, and the conciliation of the South. As a result of this tender of the palm branch, what has been the return? 1. The disfranchisement of the Negro. 2. The legal creation of a distinct status of civil inferiority. 3. The steady withdrawal of aid from institutions for the higher training of the Negro."
Dr. Du Bois, a sociologist and historian, was the first Negro to receive a doctorate from Harvard University. The philosophy expressed in his credo would be echoed more stridently by a new generation in the 1960s.
"I believe in God who made of one blood all races that dwell on earth. I believe that all men, black and brown and white, are brothers, varying through time and opportunity, in form and gift and feature, but differing in no essential particular, and alike in soul and in the possibility of infinite development. Especially do I believe in the Negro race, in the beauty of its genius, the sweetness of its soul, and its strength in that meekness which shall inherit this turbulent earth. I believe in liberty for all men, the space to stretch their arms and their souls, the right to breathe and the right to vote, the freedom to choose their friends, enjoy the sunshine and ride on the railroads, uncursed by color, thinking, dreaming, working as they will in a kingdom of God and love.
The differences between the two men led Du Bois to call together a group of progressive leaders to form a new association. The Niagara Movement held its first meeting on the U.S.-Canadian border in 1905. The Declaration of Principles included the following.
We believe that Negro American citizens should protest emphatically and continually against the curtailment of their political rights. We believe in manhood suffrage. We believe that no man is so good, intelligent, or wealthy as to be entrusted wholly with the welfare of his neighbor. We believe also in protest against the curtailment of our civil rights. All American citizens have the right to equal treatment in places of public entertainment according to their behavior and deserts. We especially complain against the denial of equal opportunities to us in economic life. In the rural districts of the South, this amounts to peonage and virtual slavery. All over the South, it tends to crush labor and small business enterprises. We refuse to allow the impression to remain that the Negro American assents to inferiority, is submissive under oppression, and apologetic before insults. Through helplessness, we may submit, but the voice of protest of 10 million Americans must never cease to assail the ears of their fellows so long as America is unjust.
Although the Niagara Movement lasted for several years, it never became a strong organization. But it did serve as a testing ground, and most of its leaders were active in forming the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. As a result of anti-Negro riots in Springfield, Illinois, in the summer of 1908, 53 prominent black and white leaders issued a call for a meeting. The purpose of the meeting was to determine how influential white citizens could help the blacks in their struggle for equality. The call to the conference said, in part,
if Mr. Lincoln could revisit this country in the flesh, he would be disheartened and discouraged. In many states, Lincoln would see the black men and women, for whose freedom 100,000 soldiers gave their lives, set apart in trains, in which they pay first-class fares for third-class service, and segregated in railway stations and in places of entertainment. He would observe that state after state declines to do its elementary duty in preparing the Negro through education for the best exercise of citizenship. Silence under these conditions means tacit approval. Hence, we call upon all the believers in democracy to join in a national conference for the discussion of present evils, the voicing of protests, and the renewal of the struggle for civil and political liberty.
As a result of the conference, the NAACP was formed. Langston Hughes wrote of its early days,
within 3 months after its organization, the NAACP opened its first local office in Chicago. That summer also, its legal work, which was eventually to have so great an effect upon American racial patterns, began when NAACP lawyers filed a petition of pardon for a Negro sharecropper in South Carolina. This man had been given the death penalty for slaying a constable who burst into his cabin after midnight to charge him with breach of contract. The young NAACP initiated an intensive publicity campaign by means of press releases and pamphlets, exposing acts of racial injustice and setting forth the association's objectives. The first issue of its official organ, The Crisis, appeared in November under the editorship of Dr. Du Bois.
In 1910, 23 outstanding Negro leaders addressed a statement to the people of Great Britain and Europe to contradict the glowing report of progress which had been made in a tour abroad by Booker T. Washington. They described the conditions of 1910 as these.
Our people were emancipated in a whirl of passion, and then left naked to the mercies of their enraged and impoverished ex-masters. As our sole means of defense, we were given the ballot, and we used it so as to secure the real fruits of the war. Without it, we would have returned to slavery. With it, we struggled toward freedom. No sooner, however,
had we rid ourselves of nearly two-thirds of our illiteracy and accumulated $600 million worth of property in a generation than this ballot, which had become increasingly necessary to the defense of our civil and property rights, was taken from us by force and fraud. Today, in 8 states where the bulk of the Negroes live, black men of property and university training can be, and usually are, by law denied the ballot, while the most ignorant white man votes. Along with this has gone a systematic attempt to curtail the education of the black race. Under a widely advertised system of universal education, not one black boy in 3 today has in the United States a chance to learn to read and write. We are usually forced to live in the worst quarters, and our consequent death rate is noted as a race trait. We are forced to take lower wages for equal work, and our standard of living is then criticized. A persistent caste proscription seeks to force us and confine us to menial occupations where the conditions of work are worst. Worse than all this is the willful miscarriage of justice in the courts. Not only have 3,500 black men been lynched publicly by mobs in the last 25 years without semblance or pretense of trial, but regularly every day throughout the South, the machinery of the courts is used not to prevent crime and correct the wayward among Negroes, but to wreak public dislike and vengeance.
At the same time that the American Negro was attempting to secure his rights, he was also reacting to the growing American imperialism. The war against Spain gave the United States control over the lives of a vast number of dark-skinned people. Louis H. Douglas, son of Frederick Douglass, attacked American expansion.
It is a sorry, though true, fact that whatever this government controls, injustice to dark races prevails. The people of Cuba, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and Manila know it well as do the wronged Indian and outraged black man in the United States. When the United States learns that justice should be blind as to race and color, then may it undertake to, with some show of propriety, expand. Now its expansion means extension of race hate and cruelty, barbarous lynchings and gross injustice to dark people.
There was a growing disillusionment with the Republican Party, which most Negroes who could vote had supported since the Civil War. In 1908, Du Bois drew up this indictment.
The Republican Party never intended to free the slaves. It never began the war with any such idea. It was willing to end the war and not touch slavery. The leaders of the Republican Party acquiesced and even defended the disfranchisement of colored voters in the South. Mr. Taft has repeatedly said it was a good thing. Mr. Roosevelt has told us to stop whining. The lily-white organizations have been recognized. A Republican Congress and a Republican Supreme Court have refused to act. And in every way, the Republican Party for 10 years have told the Negro that if he did not like what they were doing, he can get out.
Negroes who supported Democrat Woodrow Wilson in 1912 were bitterly disappointed. Wilson instituted segregation of federal employees in Washington. Monroe Trotter, editor of the Boston Guardian, was spokesman for the delegation which protested this action.
It is untenable, in view of the established facts, to maintain that the segregation is simply to avoid race friction. For the simple reason that for 50 years, white and colored clerks have been working together in peace and harmony and friendliness, doing so even through 2 Democratic administrations. Soon after your inauguration began, segregation was drastically introduced in the Treasury and Postal Departments by your appointees.
The entry of the United States into war in 1917 greatly influenced the life of the Negro. President Wilson had stated that we were fighting to save democracy. The black man believed that this fight should begin at home. In July 1917, 15,000 Negroes marched down Fifth Avenue in New York City in protest against lynchings and discrimination. They marched in silence and distributed the following leaflet to spectators.
We march because, by the grace of God and the force of truth, the dangerous, hampering walls of prejudice and inhuman injustices must fall. We march because we want to make impossible a repetition of Waco, Memphis, and East St. Louis anti-Negro riots by arousing the conscience of the country and to bring the murderers of our brothers, sisters, and innocent children to justice. We march because we deem it a crime to be silent in the face of such barbaric acts. We march because we are thoroughly opposed to Jim Crow cars, segregation, discrimination, disfranchisement, lynching, and the host of evils that are forced on us. It is time that the spirit of Christ should be manifested in the making and execution of laws. We march because we want our children to live in a better land and enjoy fairer conditions than have fallen to our lot.
Many black veterans came back with a new spirit. The crisis said, "Make way for democracy. We saved it in France, and by the great Jehovah, we will save it in the United States of America, or know the reason why." Even more important was the start of large-scale migration north. New opportunities for work developed in the northern cities, and the movement began which would soon make the race problem a national and no longer a regional problem. One of the most dramatic events in the post-war period was the Back to Africa movement, led by a West Indian black, Marcus Garvey. The Universal Negro Improvement Society, which he organized, had over 1 million members and attracted many of the poorer blacks. Garvey said,
"In view of the fact that the black man of Africa has contributed as much to the world as the white man of Europe and the brown man and yellow man of Asia, we of the Universal Negro Improvement Association demand that the white, yellow, and brown races give to the black man his place in the civilization of the world. We ask for nothing more than the rights of 400 million Negroes. The difference between the Universal Negro Improvement Association and the other movements of this country and probably the world is that the Universal Negro Improvement Association seeks independence of government, while the other organizations seek to make the Negro a secondary part of existing governments. We differ from the organizations in America because they seek to subordinate the Negro as a secondary consideration in a great civilization, knowing that in America the Negro will never reach his highest ambition, knowing that the Negro in America will never get his constitutional rights. Let the world understand that 400 million Negroes are determined to die for their liberty, and that if we must die, we shall die nobly, we shall die gallantly, fighting up the battle heights of Africa to plant there the standard which represents liberty."
Just as the Garvey movement gave evidence of a burst of racial pride among the poorer blacks, so the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s marked the coming of age of the Negro intellectual. Langston Hughes gives a vivid picture of the atmosphere of the period, and also of its limitations.
It was a period when every season there was at least one hit play on Broadway acted by a Negro cast, and when books by Negro authors were being published with much greater frequency and much more publicity than ever before or since in history. It was a period when white writers wrote about Negroes more successfully, commercially speaking, than Negroes did about themselves. It was a period, God help us, when Ethel Barrymore appeared in blackface in Scarlet Sister Mary. It was the period when the Negro was in vogue. I was there. I had a swell time while it lasted. But I thought it wouldn't last long. For how could a large and enthusiastic number of people be crazy about Negroes forever? But some Harlemites thought the millennium had come. They thought the race problem had at last been solved. They were sure the new Negro would lead a new life from then on in green pastures of tolerance, created by County Cullen, Ethel Waters, Claude McKay, Duke Ellington, Bojangles, and Aline Locke. I don't know what made any Negroes think that, except that they were mostly intellectuals doing the thinking. The ordinary Negroes hadn't heard of the Negro Renaissance, and if they had, it hadn't raised their wages any. As for all those white folks in the speakeasies and nightclubs of Harlem, well, maybe a colored man could find some place to have a drink that the tourists hadn't yet discovered.
Many of the outstanding poets of the Harlem Renaissance voiced their protests against discrimination. County Cullen sums up prejudice in this lyric.
Incident. Once riding in old Baltimore, heart-filled, head-filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now, I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger. And so I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember.
Anna Bontemps is more bitter.
A black man talks of reaping. I have sown beside all waters in my day. I planted deep within my heart the fear that wind or fowl would take the grain away. I planted safe against this stark, lean year. I scattered seed enough to plant the land in rows from Canada to Mexico. But for my reaping, only what the hand can hold at once is all that I can show. Yet, what I sowed and what the orchard yields, my brother's sons are gathering stalk and root. Small wonder, then my children glean in fields they have not sown and feed on bitter fruit.
And Langston Hughes looks to the future.
I too sing America. I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll sit at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
In the 20s, once again, a Negro was elected to Congress. Oscar DePriest of Chicago took his seat in the House of Representatives in 1929. In the debate on American occupation of Haiti, he said,
I am very glad to see the gentlemen on the minority Democratic side of this House so solicitous about the condition of the black people of Haiti. I wish to God they were equally solicitous about the black people of America. We in America would liken some of the states of this country to have the right of self-determination also, under the broad principles laid down by our Constitution.
W.E.B. Du Bois, in 1929, on the 20th anniversary of the NAACP, summed up the progress of the Negro people.
20 years ago, there was scarcely a reputable scientist who dared to assert the equality of the Negro race. Africa was assumed to have no history, and there was only one college in the United States that offered a course of study in Negro history and psychology. It was said by the Negroes themselves, almost unanimously, that real effective organization for the attainment of the rights of black men in America was impossible. But we disregarded the advice of our friends. We went in for agitation. We pushed our way into the courts. We demanded the right to vote. We urged and pushed our children into college. We encouraged Negro art and literature. We studied African history, and in season, out of season, we declared that the colored races were destined at least to share in the heritage of the earth. We stand today at the threshold of a new generation, with 12,000 of our children in college, with a recognized place in American literature and art, with the reappearance of the black man in Congress, and what is more important, with the emergence of an independent Negro vote.